No one had cause to show it at the moment. His father opened his eyes and found Henry.
Ngo wai ne jo.
The words rattled out between haggard breaths. I did it for you. That was when Henry knew. His father wasn't speaking about sending him to China, or about his planning to marry Ethel. His father was superstitious, and wanted to die with a clear conscience, so he wouldn't be haunted in the next world. His father was confessing.
You fixed it, didn't you?
Henry spoke with quiet resignation, unable to feel anger toward his dying father. He wanted to feel it, but unlike his father, he wouldn't allow himself to be defined by hatred.
You used your position with the benevolent associations and fixed it so that my letters never made it to Keiko, so that hers never got delivered. That was your doing somehow, wasn't it?
Henry looked at his father, fully expecting him to die at any moment, leaving him with that question unanswered. Instead, his father inhaled one last time, one long draw, and confirmed what Henry had already guessed. With his dying breath, he nodded, and said it again.
Oh, why, nay, Joe?
I did it for you. Henry watched his father's eyes widen as he stared at the ceiling, his mouth releasing one long, slow breath that rattled in his chest. To Henry, he almost looked surprised as his eyes closed one last time. His mother clung to Ethel, both crying. Henry couldn't look at either of them. Instead, he left his father's side and looked out the window. The excitement of the Japanese surrender was still palpable in the air, and people wandered about the streets looking for a place to continue their celebrations. Henry didn't feel like cheering. He felt like screaming. He did neither. Bolting from his parents' room and out the front door past a saddened Dr. Luke, Henry ran down the stairs and headlong down King Street, south, in the direction of Maynard Avenue, in the direction of what used to be Nihomachi. If that really had been Keiko he'd seen in the street, she'd go there to retrieve her things. He ran first to her old apartment, the one she'd vacated over 3 years ago. The apartments in the neighborhood were now being rented to Italian and Jewish families. There was no sign of her. Amid the celebration and revelry, no one noticed Henry running down the street. Everywhere he looked, everyone seemed so happy, so satisfied, the opposite of how he felt inside. He kept looking, but the only other place he could think of to go was the Panama Hotel. If her family had stored some of their belongings there, they'd have to go retrieve their things, wouldn't they? Running down South Washington, all the way past the old Nichibe Publishing Building, which was now occupied by the Roosevelt Federal Savings and Loan, Henry saw the steps of the Panama, and in front, a lone worker. The hotel was being boarded up again. It was empty, Henry thought. All he could do was hold his breath, and the anger toward his father, as he scanned the streets for Japanese faces. He looked for Mr. Okabe, imagining him in an army uniform. Keiko's last letter had said he was finally allowed to enlist. He must have been one of the thousand Henry had read about from Minidoka, who'd joined the 442nd and fought in Germany. A lawyer. They sent a Japanese lawyer to France to fight the Germans. Henry wanted to shout Keiko's name, to tell her that it was his father, that it wasn't her fault or his, that this could all be undone, that she didn't have to leave. But he couldn't bring himself to speak. Like causing ripples on a placid lake, some things are better left undisturbed. Henry stepped forward, just to the edge of the street. If he took another step toward the hotel, he knew he'd break Ethel's heart, and he knew she didn't deserve that. As he turned around,
remembering to breathe again. He saw Ethel standing there, maybe 10 feet away, parting her way through the crowded sidewalk. She must be worried about me, Henry thought. He pictured her running after him, so upset about Henry's father, about Henry himself. She approached him, but kept her distance a bit, as if not knowing what Henry needed. Henry knew. He held her hand, and she relaxed, her eyes wet with tears from the up and down emotions of the day. If she suspected or wondered, she never said a word. And if she had had an inadvertent hand in the loss of Henry's letters, she never spoke of it. But Henry knew her heart, too innocent to get caught up in his father's drama. She simply let Henry feel everything, and never questioned. She was just there when he needed her. Walking home with Ethel, Henry knew he had much to do. He had to help his mother prepare a funeral. He had to pack for his trip to China, and he had to find a suitable engagement ring, something he would do with a certain sadness. He'd do what he always did, find the sweet among the bitter. Broken Records, 1986. Henry hadn't heard from his son in a week. Marty didn't call asking to borrow a few bucks. He didn't even pop by to do his laundry or wax his Honda. Henry thought about his Chinese son, engaged to his Caucasian girlfriend, driving around in a Japanese car. Henry's own father must have been spinning in his grave. The thought made him smile. A little. Marty didn't have a phone in his dorm, and the community phone in the hallway just rang and rang each time Henry tried to reach him. So after his visit to Kobe Park, Henry walked over to the south end of Capitol Hill and passed the security desk at Seattle University's Bellarmine Hall. The front desk watchman was busy studying as Henry strolled to the elevator and pressed 6, the top floor. Henry was grateful that his son had moved up from the 4th floor before his senior year. 4 was an unlucky number. In Chinese, the word for 4 rhymed with the word for death. Marty didn't share his father's built-in superstitions, but Henry was happy nonetheless. Henry smiled politely as he stepped off the elevator, nearly running into a pair of co-eds in bathrobes returning from the showers. "Pops!" Marty yelled down the hall. "What are you doing here?" Henry ambled to his son's room, around 2 young men wheeling in a keg of beer in a shopping cart, and passed another girl with an armload of laundry. "Are you okay? You never come here," Marty said, his eyes questioning Henry as he stood in the doorway, feeling out of place and beyond his years. "I mean, I'm graduating in a week, and now you show up? When everyone is kicking back? You're going to think all that hard-earned tuition went to waste up here." "I just came by to bring you this." Henry handed a small thank-you card to his son. "It's for Sam, for making us dinner." "Ah, Pops, you didn't have to..." "Please," Henry said. It was the first time since Ethel had died that he'd made any attempt to visit Marty. During his freshman year, Ethel had made it a point to hand-deliver care packages, when her health allowed her to get out once in a while. Henry, by contrast, had never come alone. Looking around Marty's room, he saw Keiko's sketchbooks spread out on the desk. Henry didn't say much. He didn't like talking about Keiko's things in front of Marty, as if his excitement and joy at finding them somehow tarnished the image of Ethel. Too soon. It was far too soon. "I'm sorry about what Samantha said, Pops, about finding Keiko. She's just a little caught up in the moment, you know what I mean?" Henry did. It was understandable. The belongings at the Panama Hotel were drawing the attention of a few local historians. A certain fascination was to be expected. "She's fine," Henry said. "But she does have a point?" "About returning the sketchbooks to the rightful owner?" "No, about finding out if she's alive, where she might be."
Henry looked at Marty's shelves. On them sat a Chinese tea service and a set of porcelain rice bowls that had been given to him and Ethel for their wedding. They were worn, chipped, and cracks were everywhere just beneath the hardened finish.
I had my chance.
What, back during the war?
She was taken from you.
She didn't want to leave,
and you didn't want her to go.
And the things Ye Ye did and said, the way he interfered,
how can you just accept all that?
Marty had an old rice cooker simmering on a table near the window. Henry pulled the steamer away from the wall and unplugged it out of precautionary habit, letting it cool. He looked at his son, unsure of how to answer.
You could have been together.
Henry interrupted, drying his hands on a towel as he spoke.
I had my chance. I let her go. She left, but I also let her go.
He hung the towel from the closet door handle, his hands clean. He'd thought about Keiko so many times over the years, even during those empty, lonely nights, while Ethel was taking that long, slow journey toward her final destination. He'd been barely able to hold her, because she was in so much pain. And when he did, she was so heavily medicated, she didn't know he was there. It had been a hard, bitter road he had walked alone, as he'd had to walk to and from Rainier Elementary as a boy. Keiko, how he'd wished she were there in those moments. But I made my decision, Henry thought. I could have found her after the war. I could have hurt Ethel and had what I wanted. But it didn't seem right. Not then. And not these past few years. I had my chance, he said it, retiring from a lifetime of wanting. I had my chance. And sometimes in life, there are no second chances. You look at what you have, not what you miss, and you move forward. Henry watched his son listen. For the first time in many years, Marty seemed content to listen, not to argue. Like that broken record we found, Henry said. Some things just can't be fixed. Hearthstone, 1986. Henry couldn't quite bring himself to run through the sleepy, well-appointed halls of the Hearthstone Inn. Running just seemed to fly in the face of the quiet dignity the quaint and elegant nursing home maintained. Besides, he might run over some old lady and her walker. Old. What a relative term. He felt old whenever he thought about Marty getting married. He'd felt old when Ethel passed. Yet here he was, feeling like a little kid who might be scolded for running in the halls. When Henry had got the call that Sheldon's health had taken a turn for the worse, he didn't grab his coat, wallet, or anything. Just his keys, and out the door he flew. He'd let little slow him down on the drive over, rolling through two red lights. He'd received the call before, and was used to a variety of false alarms. But he knew better this time. He recognized death when it was sitting right there waiting. After having listened to Ethel's breathing change, that shift in her state of mind, he understood. And now, visiting his friend, he knew the end was close. Sheldon had taken ill on several occasions, usually because of a lifetime of untreated diabetes. By the time he began to take care of himself, and by the time he fell into the hands of the right doctors, the damage had already been done. "How is he?" Henry asked, stopping at the nearest nurse's station and pointing to Sheldon's room, where a nurse was wheeling out a dialysis machine. No use anymore, Henry thought. They're taking him off everything. The nurse, a plump, red-haired woman, who looked about Marty's age, read her computer screen, then looked back to Henry. It's close. His wife was just here,
She left to go get more family. It's funny, after all those little strokes, you fight off the visitors, just as part of the process of letting someone rest, hoping they'll recover soon. But when it's this time, this close, it's nothing but family and friends. It's that time, I'm afraid. Henry saw the genuine concern in her eyes. Knocking on the half-open door, he slipped inside. He padded quietly across the tiled floor, looking at the array of equipment usually assigned to Sheldon. Most of it had been unplugged and wheeled to a cluttered corner. Henry sat down on a wheeled chair next to his friend, who was propped up so he could breathe more easily, his head slumped to one side, nestled against a pillow facing Henry, and a thin, clear tube draped around his nose. The whistling sound from the oxygen was the only sound in the room. There was a CD player near Sheldon's bed. Henry adjusted the volume to low and pressed play. The smooth bebop rhythm of Floyd Standifer filled the quiet of the empty room, like a steady flow of sand filling the bottom of an hourglass. Less time each second. Henry patted his friend's arm, mindful of the IV protruding from the back of Sheldon's hand, noting scabbed-over dots, marking the landscape of his medical condition and recent removal of other tubes and monitors. Sheldon's eyes opened, eyelids flicking, his chin falling from side to side, his eyes finding Henry. He felt saddened for his friend, a sadness that was mollified when Henry spied the broken record next to Sheldon's bed. "I've been here too many times," Henry thought to himself. "So many years with my wife, now with my old friend. Too soon. It's been a lifetime, but it's still too soon for everyone." Henry had clung to his grief and sadness with Ethel's passing. And now this. He saw the confusion in Sheldon's eyes. He recognized the vacant stare of not knowing where you are or why you're here.
"Home. Time to go home," was all Sheldon kept saying over and over again quietly, in a way that sounded almost pleading. "This is home for now. Then I think Minnie will be coming back with the rest of your family." Henry had known Sheldon's second wife, Minnie, for years, but hadn't gotten around to visiting them as often as he'd have liked.
"Henry, fix it."
"Fix what?" Henry asked, feeling oddly grateful for those hard final weeks with Ethel. That experience made this difficult exchange seem normal. Then Henry saw what Sheldon was looking at. The old vinyl 78, split in two.
"The record. You want me to fix the Oscar Holden record, don't you?"
Sheldon closed his eyes and drifted off into deep sleep, the kind of in and out that only someone in his condition can accomplish. Such heavy, labored breathing. Then back, eyes open, lucid again, like waking up to a new day.
"Henry, I'm here. What are you doing here? Is it Sunday?"
"No."
Henry looked at his old friend, smiling, trying to be cheery despite the circumstances.
"No, it's not Sunday."
"That's too bad. All these midweek visits. Must be time for my final performance, huh, Henry?"
Sheldon coughed a little and struggled to make his aching lungs work the way they should. Watching his old friend, still so tall and dignified, even lying here dying, Henry looked at the old broken record that sat on the wheeled nightstand next to the bed.
"Earlier, you were asking me to fix it. I'm guessing you meant fix this old broken record. Maybe find some place to restore it?"
Looking at Sheldon, Henry wasn't sure if, in his state,
He remembered the conversation they'd started just minutes before.
"I think it's time you fixed it, Henry. But I wasn't talking about that old record. If you can put those broken pieces together, make some music again, then that's what you should do. But I wasn't talking about the record, Henry."
Henry looked at the Oscar Holden recording, the one he'd hoped would still be there in the dusty basement of that old hotel. Sheldon reached over and held Henry's hand. His old, dried-up, brown-bagged fingers still felt strong to Henry.
"We both," Sheldon paused, then caught his breath again, "know why you were always looking for that old record. Always known."
His breathing slowed.
"Fix it,"
Sheldon managed to say one last time before drifting off to sleep, his words disappearing into the soft hissing of the oxygen.
Tickets, 1986. Stepping inside Bud's Jazz Records, Henry could smell the vanilla tobacco that Bud favored. The proprietor was smoking and chewing on an old pipe, looking at a coffee-stained copy of the Seattle Weekly. He lowered his paper just enough to give Henry a nod and a dip of the pipe, which hung precariously from the side of his hangdog mouth. As always, he looked about 3 days late for a good shave. In the background, a woman sang some sweet old-school number. Helen Humes? From the 30s? Henry couldn't be sure. Tucked under Henry's arm was a brown paper sack, and inside was the broken Oscar Holden record. Henry had haunted Bud's place for years in search of it. Sure, he had felt a little bad taking it from Sheldon's room, but his old friend had been sleeping, and when he was awake, he was more and more disoriented. The silent lucidity gave way to moments of confusion and bewilderment, like his old friend's ramblings about fixing what was broken. The record? Henry himself? That was unknown. Still, after all these years, Henry wanted to hear the song embedded in these two broken slabs of vinyl. And maybe it would be good for Sheldon to hear it one last time as well. Henry didn't know the first thing about restoring antique records, but Bud had been here forever. If anyone could point Henry in the right direction, it would be Bud. Henry walked up to the counter and set the bag on the cracked glass display case that held old sheet music and vinyl and wax discs too brittle to be handled. Bud set down his paper. "You returning something, Henry?" Henry just smiled, enjoying the last strains of the woman singing in the background. He always favored the gravelly tenors, but on occasion, a bluesy, brandy-soaked voice like the one playing could keep him awake all night.
"Henry, you okay?"
"I have something I need to show you."
Bud tamped out his pipe.
"Now why do I get the feeling this has something to do with that old busted-up hotel on Main Street?"
Henry reached into the bag and slid out the record, still in its original paper sleeve. It felt heavy in his hand. The label through the cutaway in the sleeve was clearly visible, a yellow, faded printing that read, "Oscar Holden and the Midnight Blue." Henry watched Bud's heavy eyes widen, and the bitter grooves in the old man's forehead smoothed out like a sail caught up in a full breeze, as he smiled in bewilderment. He looked up at Henry, then back down at the record, as if to say, "Can I touch it?" Henry nodded.
"Go ahead. It's real."
"You found this down there, didn't you? Never gave up looking for it, did you?"
"Never gave up. Knew I'd find it eventually. It was there, all these years, waiting."
Bud slid the record out as Henry watched it give in his hand. The two broken halves sagged in opposite directions,
held together by the pressed label.
Oh, no, 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 no. You're not going to tease me like this, are you, Henry? It's broke, ain't it?
Henry just nodded and shrugged his apology.
I was thinking maybe that was something you could help me with. I'm looking for someone who can do some kind of restoration.
Bud looked like he'd found out he'd won the lottery, only to be paid off in a lifetime supply of Monopoly money. Exciting, but useless.
If it wasn't completely in two, you could send it someplace, and they'd use a laser to record off every note. Wouldn't even touch it with a traditional needle, not even a diamond. Couldn't risk more scratches and pops. They could suck off every nuance ever recorded here, and save it for you digitally.
Bud rubbed his forehead. The wrinkles all came back.
Ain't nothing you can do with a busted record, Henry. Once she's gone for good.
They couldn't just glue it or something?
Henry, she's gone. It'd never play, never sound the same. I mean, I love holding it and all, and this does belong in a museum or something. A little piece of history for sure. Especially since those in the know never knew for sure if it was actually recorded.
Bud knew it. Inside, Henry knew it, too. Some things just can't be put back together. Some things can never be fixed. Two broken pieces can't make a lot of anything anymore. But at least he had the broken pieces.
Henry walked home. It was probably more than 2 miles. Up South King, and around toward Beacon Hill, overlooking the International District. It would have been much easier to drive, even with the traffic, but he just felt like walking. He'd spent his childhood canvassing this neighborhood, and with each step, he tried to recall what used to be. As he walked, he crossed over to South Jackson, looking at the buildings that used to be home to the Ubangi Club, the rocking chair, even the Black Elks Club. Holding that broken record at his side, now looking at generic storefronts for Seifer's Bank and All West Travel, he tried to remember the song he'd once played over and over in his head. It was all but gone. He could remember a bit of the chorus, but its melody had escaped. Yet he couldn't forget her, couldn't forget Keiko, and how he'd once told her he'd wait a lifetime. Every summer he'd thought of her, but never spoke of her to anyone, not even Ethel. And of course, telling Marty had been out of the question. So when his impetuous son had wanted so badly to go to the Puyallup Fair each year, and Henry had said no, there was a reason. A painful reason. One that Henry shared with almost no one but Sheldon, on the rare occasion when his old friend would bring it up. And now Sheldon would be gone soon, too. Another former resident of a small community in Seattle that no one remembered anymore. Like ghosts haunting a vacant lot because the building had long since vanished. At home, exhausted from the long walk along the dirty, littered streets, Henry hung up his jacket, went to the kitchen for a glass of iced tea, and drifted to the bedroom he'd once shared with Ethel. To his surprise, on his bed was his best suit, set out like it had been all those years ago. His old black leather dress shoes had been polished and placed on the floor, next to an old suitcase of his. For a moment, Henry felt 15 again, in that old Canton Alley apartment he'd shared with his parents. Looking at the tools of a traveler bound for ports unknown, a future far away. Mystified, Henry felt the hair on the back of his neck prick up as he turned back the lapel of his suit coat and saw, like a mirage, a ticket jacket in his breast pocket. Sitting on the edge of the bed, he pulled it out and opened it up. Inside was a round-trip ticket to New York City. It wasn't to Canton, but to another faraway land, a place he'd never been.
"I guess you found my little present." Marty stood in the doorway, holding his father's hat, the one with the threadbare brim.
Most children
just send their aged parents to a nursing home. You're sending me to the other side of the country, Henry said.
More than that, Pops. I'm sending you back in time.
Henry looked at the suit, thinking about his own father. He knew only one person who had ever talked about New York, and she'd never come back. She'd left a long time ago, back in another lifetime.
You sending me back to the war years? Henry asked.
I'm sending you back to find what's missing. Sending you back to find what you let go. I'm proud of you, Pops, and I'm grateful for everything, especially for the way you cared for Mom. You've done everything for me, and now it's my turn to do something for you.
Henry looked at the ticket.
I found her, Pops. I know you were always loyal to Mom, and that you'd never do this for yourself. So I did it for you. Pack your suitcase. I'm taking you to the airport. You're leaving for New York City.
When? Henry asked. Tonight? Tomorrow? Whenever.
You got someplace else you gotta be?
Henry drew out a tarnished silver pocket watch. It kept poor time and required frequent winding. He flipped it open, sighed heavily, then snapped it shut. The last time someone had laid out a suit and a pair of dress shoes, with a ticket purchased for a faraway place, Henry had refused to go. This time, Henry refused to stay. Sheldon's Song, 1986. Sheldon didn't have much time left, Henry knew for certain. With his friend's failing health, the desire to go to New York to find Keiko would have to be put on hold. It had been 40 years. He could wait a while longer. He would have to wait. At the Hearthstone Inn, Sheldon had enjoyed a steady stream of visitors, family, friends, and former co-workers, even a few loyal music fans who recognized his place in the paved-over history of Seattle's once vibrant jazz scene. But now, most of his well-wishers had come and gone. They'd paid their last respects to a man they loved, just as family remained, along with the minister from Sheldon's church, trying his best to comfort the family.
"How is he?" Henry asked Minnie, a silver-haired woman 10 years the junior of the old sax man. She hugged Henry in the doorway and let go, but still held on to his elbows, her wrinkled eyes puffy, showing the redness from so much crying, her cheeks still damp.
"It won't be long now, Henry. We know that. I know that. We're just so ready for him to have his peace, to not be in any pain," she said.
Henry felt a quiver in his lip, something that surprised even him. He bit his tongue and stood up taller, not wanting his tears to add to Minnie's grief.
"Is this your doing? The music, I mean? The record?"
Henry felt horrible. He'd taken the record, and now everyone knew it was missing. He held it tight under his arm, beneath his coat, to keep it out of the misty rain that filled the Seattle air.
I can't explain. No need to explain, Henry. I mean,
she was searching for the right words.
It's amazing. Like a miracle, really. Listen. Can you hear it? It sounds like a miracle to me. And for the first time in 40 years, Henry heard it.
Playing in Sheldon's room was the long-forgotten song he'd first heard in the Black Elks Club, the Oscar Holden song he and Keiko had shared. Their song, but Sheldon's too. And it was playing, loud and clear. Walking into the room, Henry saw a woman standing there. In his mind's eye, he thought it might be Keiko. Her caring smile was almost as bright. But it was Samantha, sitting next to an old portable record player, the boxed kind
you could check out of the public library years ago. On it spun a complete vinyl recording of Oscar Holden's lost classic, The Alley Cat Strut, the song he dedicated to Henry and Keiko. Sheldon lay unconscious, drifting in and out of that gray, empty space between life and whatever fate had in store for him next. Beside him were an assorted collection of kids and grandchildren, many of whom Henry recognized from earlier meetings or from the photos Sheldon had proudly shared when he and Henry would get together over the years.
"I like Grandpa's record," a little girl confided. Henry estimated her to be about 6, a great-granddaughter, perhaps.
"It's wonderful, Henry," Samantha said, smiling with bright eyes wet but hopeful. "You should have seen him smile when we put it on and played it the first time. Like he'd been wanting to hear this, needing to hear this, all these years."
"But,"
Henry took out the broken record he held in his coat.
"Where?"
"She sent it." Samantha said it with a glowing reverence, like a bit player in awe of a featured performer about to set foot on the main stage. "Marty found her living on the East Coast, and she asked about you, asked about everyone, Sheldon too. And when she found out, she sent the record immediately. Can you believe that? She kept it all those years, the Holy Grail you knew existed." She handed Henry a note. "This came for you." Henry hesitated, not quite believing what he was hearing. He gently tore open the envelope. He felt as though he were sleepwalking as he read Keiko's words.
"Dear Henry, I pray that this note finds you in good health, good spirits, and among good friends, especially Sheldon, whom I hope is comforted by this record. Our record, really. It belonged to all of us, didn't it? But more important, it belonged to you and me. I'll never forget seeing your face in the train station, or how I felt standing in the rain on the inside of that barbed wire fence. What a pair we were. As you play this record, I hope you'll think of the good, not the bad, of what was, not what wasn't meant to be, of the time we spent together, not the time we've spent apart. Most of all, I hope you'll think of me."
Henry folded the letter with trembling hands, unable to continue. He had had a hard time revealing the true nature of what was found in the dusty basement of the Panama Hotel that day. He'd felt as if it might tarnish the way his son looked at him, or the way he might look at his mother. But in the end, as in so many of Henry's father and son moments, he'd had it wrong. Marty wanted him to be happy. To Henry, Keiko was lost in time. But to Marty, a few hours on his computer, a few phone calls, and there she was, alive and well, living in New York City, even after all these years. Henry smiled, reached out, and grabbed hold of Samantha's hand.
"You're amazing,"
he struggled to find the words. "Marty has done well. Amazingly well." Looking at Sheldon, Henry sat on the edge of the bed, his hand on his friend's arm, watching his rattled breathing. His body shutting down, laboring for each breath. Sheldon looked hot and feverish. His body was losing the ability to regulate his own temperature. He was burning himself up. As Henry watched his dying friend, he listened to the record, waiting for a saxophone solo he hadn't heard in 4 decades. As the band slowed and the brittle recorded melody kicked in, Sheldon opened his eyes. He looked up, as if regarding Henry. Sheldon's mouth moved, straining to get the words out. Henry moved in, placing his ear close to hear Sheldon's whispered words.
"You fixed it."
Henry nodded.
"I fixed it."
And soon, I'm going to fix everything.
3 hours later, with Minnie at his side, surrounded by a lifetime supply of family and grandchildren, Sheldon opened his eyes again. Henry was there, Marty and Samantha too. In the background, the strains of Oscar Holden and the Midnight Blue echoed in the shadowed corners of the room. The lungs that had once powered the sounds of South Jackson, playing to the delight of a generation, breathed slowly one last time and whispered the final notes of his song. Henry watched Sheldon's eyes close and his body lighten, as if his entire frame were waving a slow goodbye. Beneath the simple bars of the tune playing, Henry whispered to no one but the spirit of his friend.
Thank you, sir, and you have a fine day.
New York, 1986. Henry had never been to New York City. Oh, sure, maybe once or twice in a dream. But in full waking reality, it was a place he'd thought of often over the years, but never allowed himself to visit. It seemed a world away, not just across the country or on another coast, but someplace beyond the horizon, lost in another time. In the $40 cab ride from LaGuardia Airport, Henry held the complete Oscar Holden record on his lap. It had been played at Sheldon's funeral, the same one he had hand-carried on the plane from Seattle, his one piece of carry-on luggage, a conversation piece everywhere he went. When he explained where the record came from, its unique history, and the circumstances of life at the time, people always gushed their amazement. Even the young blonde woman sitting next to him on the plane, who was flying to New York on business, couldn't believe he was hand-carrying the only remaining playable copy. She'd forgotten how horribly cruel the Japanese internment was. She was in awe of the Panama Hotel survival, a place of personal belongings, cherished memories, forgotten treasures.
First time to the city?
The cab driver asked. He'd been eyeing Henry in the rearview mirror, but his passenger was lost in thought, staring out the window at the brick-and-mortar landscape that rolled by, a non-stop ebb and flow of yellow taxis, sleek limousines, and pedestrians who swarmed the sidewalks.
First time, was all Henry could manage to say.
Marty and Samantha had wanted him to call first, to call ahead, but he couldn't bring himself to pick up the phone. He was too nervous, like now.
This is it, 1200 block of Waverly Place, the driver called out.
His arm, which hung out the open window, pointed to a small apartment building.
This is Greenwich Village?
You're looking at it, pal.
Henry paid the driver an additional $30 to take his bags 1 mile over to the Marriott, where he dropped them off with the bellman. A strange thought, trusting someone in the big city, Henry noted to himself. But that was what this trip was really all about, wasn't it? Blind faith. And besides, he had nothing to lose. What were some luggage and a change of clothes compared with finding and fixing a broken heart? The apartment building looked old and modest, but a flat there still probably cost a fortune compared with the simple house Henry had occupied in Seattle for the past 40 years. Looking at the address Marty had given to him, Henry went inside and found himself on the 8th floor, a Chinese lucky number. Standing in the hallway, he stared at the door of Kei Hatsune, a widow of 3 years. Henry didn't know what had happened to her husband. If Marty knew, he hadn't said. Just that Kay was indeed Keiko. Henry looked at the record in his hand. When he took it partway out of the sleeve, the vinyl looked impossibly new. She must have taken impeccable care of it over the years. Putting the record away, Henry straightened the line of the old two-piece suit his son had set out for him, checked his hair and the shine of his shoes. He touched his face where he'd shaved on the plane. Then he knocked. Twice. before he heard the shuffled steps of someone inside. A shadow fell across the eyepiece in the door. Then, he heard the tumble of the locks. As the door opened, Henry felt the warmth from the inside windows shining through, illuminating the darkened hallway. Standing in front of him was a woman in her 50s, her hair shorter than he remembered, with an occasional streak of gray. She was slender, and held the door with trim fingers and manicured nails. Her chestnut brown eyes, despite the lifetime she wore and the lovely lines of her face, shone as clear and fluid as ever. The same eyes that had looked inside him all those years ago. Hopeful eyes. She paused momentarily, not completely recognizing him. Then, her hands cupped her mouth, then touched her cheeks in surprise. Keiko sighed, a confession in her smile.
"I'd almost given up on you."
She opened the door wide for Henry to come in. Inside her tiny apartment hung an assortment of watercolors and oils, of cherry blossoms and ume trees, of lonesome prairie and barbed wire. Henry knew the paintings were all Keiko's. They had the same touch, only a grown-up version of the way she'd expressed herself as a girl, the way she remembered things.
"Can I get you something? Some iced tea?"
"That'd be nice. Thank you," Henry answered, amazed that he was having this conversation, and that it sounded so normal, like a natural extension, a follow-up, to where they'd left off 40 years earlier, as if they hadn't each lived a lifetime apart. While she disappeared into the kitchen, Henry was drawn to the photos on her mantle, of her and her husband, her family. He touched a framed photo of her father, in an army uniform, a member of the famed 442nd. He and a group of Japanese-American soldiers were standing in the snow, smiling, proudly holding a captured German flag. Written on it were the words, "Go for broke." Henry found a tiny silver frame nearby. He picked it up and wiped a thin coat of dust from the glass. It was a black-and-white sketch of him and Keiko from Camp Minidoka. He had a peaceful, contented grin. She was sticking her tongue out. Minidoka was gone now, long gone, but she had kept the drawing. Near a window, an old stereo caught his eye. Next to it sat a small collection of Seattle jazz recordings, vinyl 78s of Palmer Johnson, Wanda Brown, and Leon Vaughn. Henry carefully removed the record he'd been carrying and gently placed it on the turntable. He turned the old dial, watching the label begin to spin as he delicately set the needle in the outside groove. In his heart, music began to play. Sheldon's record. His and Keiko's song. Complete with bumps and scratches. It was old and hollow-sounding. Imperfect. But it was enough. When he turned around, Keiko was standing there, the grown-up woman Keiko had become, a mother, a widow, an artist, handing him a glass of iced green tea with ginger and honey from the taste of it. They stood there, smiling at each other, like they had done all those years ago, standing on either side of that fence.
"Oh, I'd like to," she paused.
"Ureshi desu," Henry said softly. Author's note. Though this is a work of fiction, many of the events, particularly those dealing with the internment of Japanese Americans, did occur as described. As an author, I did my best to recreate this historic landscape without judging the good or bad intentions of those involved at the time. My intent was not to create a morality play, with my voice being the loudest on the stage,
but rather to defer to the reader's sense of justice, of right and wrong, and let the facts speak plainly. And while I strove mightily to be true to those facts, the blame for any historical or geographical errors lay firmly at my feet. Because many people have asked, let me say yes, the Panama Hotel is a very real place. And yes, the belongings of 37 Japanese families do indeed reside there, most of them in the dusty, dimly lit basement. If you happen to visit, be sure to stop in at the tea room, where many of these artifacts are on display. I highly recommend the Lai Chi blend. It never disappoints. Bud's Jazz Records is there too, just down the street, in the heart of Seattle's Pioneer Square. It's easy to miss, but hard to forget. I popped in once to take some publicity photos. The owner simply asked, "Is this for good or for evil?" I said, "Good, of course." "Good enough for me," was his smooth reply. However, if you're stopping at either place, looking for a long-lost Oscar Holden recording, you might be out of luck. Though Oscar was certainly one of the great fathers of the Northwest jazz scene, to my knowledge, a vinyl recording does not exist. But you never know. This is Fyodor Chin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet by Jamie Ford. This program was produced and directed by Jill Whitesides. Executive producers, Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright, 2009 by James Ford. Production copyright, 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.